we're attacked 15 times, and I reckon on every one of the attacks on the roads, I would have been sound asleep.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
And welcome to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
Now, what sounded like a fairly humorous introduction, contacted 15 times and asleep for every single one, speaks volumes about our next guest, Ben. And the reason why is our next guest, Andrew James, or Jim Molan, showed he had incredible trust in the team looking after him, was working incredibly long hours. In fact, at that particular moment in time when he was contacted 15 times, he was in Iraq, assisting in running the operations in Iraq and working 20-hour days, 7 days a week. And also, he understood the value of sleep wherever you could get it. Jim Molan is our highest-ranking military officer we've had on the show.
Without a doubt.
He's a diplomat, an author, a speaker, and most recently, a politician, the Senator for New South Wales. A fascinating chat with Jim, where actually we've built a bit of a Trojan horse, having provided him his close protection team leader. And in this interview, we give a little bit of return insight on the then-General Jim Molan in Iraq being looked after by a guy that we picked, Ben.
Yeah, it's really funny to get the two sides of that story, but only a part of this interview. Some really interesting reflections from Jim on all sorts of subjects, ranging from the benefits of country and Western music all the way through to some deeper stuff on leadership.
Well, let's hear about it. Let's get on with the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Tim.
G'day, Ben.
Hello, Tim. And we are extremely lucky to be joined by Jim Molan, AODSC. Jim, how are you?
I'm well, Tim and Ben. It's lovely to be here talking to you.
And yeah. I should probably set the scene. We're sitting up here in Crown Towers with a beautiful view over the Perth skyline.
Good. This is not a paid advertisement.
No, it's not. But if Crown would like to throw us a weekend getaway.
Sponsorship.
We'd well and truly take it.
So, Jim, you're Andrew James Molan. Let's get to the deep stuff first. Why not Andrew? Why Jim?
I'm not too sure, but by the time I was cognizant, which I guess was about 25.
Tim's still getting there.
That's right. I was called Jim, and my father's name was Andrew, and Andrew was a family name, but there were so many Andrews that I guess my mother agreed to pay homage to my father, and then we decided who I was. It would appear that I'm a Jim Molan. But on every bloody credit card I've got on a driver's license, I'm Andrew. But I guess as a politician, I am Jim.
Well, thank you, true. I want to talk now. Time in belong, sit down, not talk, giaman, something, nothing. What I've essentially just said there in Papua New Guinea and talk pissing is thanks to Jim for joining us. And now it's time to sit down and either talk shit or something about nothing. And I say that because you did a little bit of time in the Pacific Islands Regiment where, incidentally, we have 0.09% of our listening population.
Oh, that's not bad at all. And I think that's roughly the same number of people that actually listen to what I said. Not a regiment. But any good play through this play, talk busy.
Good play.
Me looking ting ting long, I'll get that talk busy now. And I do, I've forgotten almost all the talk pigeon that I had. And in those days, of course, we got no preparation. I went straight from graduating at Duntroon. January, I went straight to PNG. Nowadays, you'd be put on a cultural course, a language course. Yeah. And so I got up to PNG and discovered that none of my soldiers spoke workable English. And so I bought myself a Pidgin English book and started working my way through it. And then I managed to charge a soldier that got up to the CO, and the CO then discovered, when I tried to give my evidence in English, that none of us new lieutenants could speak Pidgin. So he then instituted a Wednesday pigeon only throughout the entire battalion. Well, we overcame that, didn't we? We just didn't do anything.
didn't talk anything.
But in the end, we did. And, you know, language is the key. And I did a similar thing in Indonesian. In that the army invested training in language for me. But in Iraq, of course, I worked through an interpreter, and that was a real disadvantage, a real disadvantage.
So our best two questions already been asked, Ben. We should probably preface some of our more shallower questions with this. So you know, Jim, that we're not a conventional podcast. Mm. Both Ben and my first careers were in the SAS regiment. We're less eloquent. We're less technically proficient. But we are more insubordinate in a learned way.
Respectful.
Yeah. Respectful insubordination. Yeah. So we thought, along with our decent slice of underpreparedness, we might use some of that in our discussion today on what has been a very long and distinguished career in service, full stop. However, I'm going to warn you that once upon a time, Henry Kissinger used the phrase before a media conference, "Are there any questions for the answers I'm about to give?" And what he meant by that is, no matter what question you ask, I'm going to give the answer that I want to give. Now, so if you firstly as a general and secondly as a politician, if you try and do a Kissinger, we're going to call you out.
That's okay. Having been on the media quite often, having done Q&A 5 times, I'm used to being abused.
So let me start with a general question. What are you most proud of in your career?
In my career, which is only a part of your life, I still think I'd go for two things. The first thing I'd go for is my period as commander of the 1st Division in the Deployable Joint Force Headquarters. Now, we did nothing spectacular. I took over from Peter Cosgrove when Peter went to East Timor. But that was the Australian culmination of everything the Army had prepared me for over 35 years. Mm-hmm. And it was an extraordinary privilege. In those days, the 15,000 people in that division of 5 brigades were actually commanded by Headquarters 1 Div. It was an extraordinary manifestation of leading, training, preparing, and doing things. And I'd come from 1 brigade some years beforehand, because we weren't the operational deployment force, no one cared what we did. Mm. The entire high command of the military in Australia concentrated on 1 brigade, and that was the 3rd brigade, and you guys, of course, in the Special Air Service. And we just went around and did what we wanted to do. And that's a great opportunity. You know, if you can get resources, and we were very good at getting resources from all over the place, you know, armoured resources that we didn't own, or air resources that we didn't own. And so we did a lot of the kind of warfare which I believe this nation will need going into the future. And that's a key point. But this, the other thing that I am proud of is my time in Iraq. And it was something that we all prepare ourselves. It was a fighting, killing war. Something that we all prepare ourselves with as military people for our entire life. And I was given an opportunity there to be part of a highly moral, highly upright activity, highly contentious, incredibly contentious activity. But in our minds and the minds of the Americans who worked for me, this was a highly principled activity. So you put those two things together and you get a preparation for what military should always be prepared for, and that is to fight. And I guess if you'd permit me to add one more thing in, and that would be what we did in my second posting to Indonesia. My first posting to Indonesia was really a consolidation of my links to Indonesia, my language, my understanding of the country, my understanding of diplomacy. And my second, that was 3 years long. The second posting was 2 years, and that was the fall of Suharto, the East Timor activities, the Asian financial crisis collapse of that country. And I tell you what, you know, when you and last night we were I'm in Perth at the moment for the SAS Resources Fund, and we spoke about this last night because it's the 20th anniversary of what we did there. And I haven't thought about it for years. I had a gutful of Indonesia and East Timor when I left, and I went straight into many other things. And I hadn't thought of it till I went back and started reading the accounts that I had written some years ago. And what we achieved there, what I was able to do there was great, but what we as a nation did there was fabulous, regardless of how it went afterwards.
And maybe, you know, pride grows with time. We're reflecting with the benefit of 20 years past that particular point in time.
I consolidated my views in 2008 in the form of a book. A multiple best-selling book, I'd have to say. When military books normally sell 3,000 copies, this book sold just under 50,000 copies. Yeah. And that's fabulous. But if our views of what we did in those time, because we're in the middle of it, can sometimes get confused, I saw a tweet this morning which took every part of the achievement away from Australia and gave it to the American Marines who were off the coast, theoretically off the coast. Well, I was there for a bloody long time. I saw and heard no Marines off the coast. But there are so many myths and legends that come out of these fights. So if we're a bit confused, those people who had no exposure to it, who are ideologically opposed to everything that we did and everything that governments and Australia does, well, they're much more confused than we'll ever be.
Yeah. We're going to circle back to Iraq and operational service and certainly your first career in uniform. But before we do, I want to ask the opposite question. That was all about what are you most proud of. What are you least proud of?
That's a harder question because I have a philosophy whereby I think that you should examine yourself for your good points and your bad points, and then you never tell people what your bad points are. Because in any bureaucracy, in any big organisation, people will use that against you. I guess most recently, I have embarked on a totally new career, being a politician. And at my age, you know, I'm not a young guy starting at 35 or 25 years old and becoming a politician whereby you can make mistakes and you can then stay in the game and improve on them. I guess the most recent bounce that I've had, I disappointed myself in that I didn't know everything that people who have been politicians for 20 years, particularly in the Liberal Party, know very, very well. So most things I do in the Liberal Party, this is the first time I've ever done them. And people tend to think that I know everything because I'm older and I've got a background, whereas I don't. And I depend on people, and I'm just finding out now how much I don't know about politics. But I tell you what, it's an extraordinary good game to be in. So I don't criticise myself. I regret not knowing everything, but it's impossible to know everything like that. The value for this country in bringing people in at every age, from every background into politics, is unchallengeable, in my view. Mm.
Before we leave this pretty rich discussion topic, let's talk a bit about leadership. So interesting that the two really proud moments that you cited were both at really fairly high levels of leadership within the military.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't get anywhere near that high. But I remember a big transition in the style of leadership between that beautiful sort of intimate leadership at the platoon command sort of level, that real human-to-human contact sport type leadership. And then the further up you get, you need to use different styles. And I imagine, again, once you get into politics, it's a different variation on the theme. I'd be interested in your thoughts on, I guess, any universal principles that have gone throughout all of those leadership contexts and what are the key differences?
I'm not very good on the theory of leadership at all. And I've taught leadership and I've been through it all and I've studied leadership. And the way that I believe, and you guys may have a different view, but the way that I believe that we teach leadership in the military is we give you a bit of basic instruction, then we send you out to do it, but then we supervise. And I have been less than effective on occasions in the supervising and mentoring area of my subordinates. On other occasions, I've been okay. There's no use. And I see it in non-military organisations all the time, putting people into responsible positions and just letting them go. You can't do it. And I see it particularly in politics. I see it time and time again. Of course, there are enduring characteristics. And I think that probably one of the most important is knowing your job. Knowing what to do. And I came back from Iraq, and I'm someone who has taken very seriously the personal study of my profession as a military leader. And I came back from Iraq, and Staff College, of course, asked me to talk to the classes quite often. And I put down a whole bunch of principles that I thought were absolutely critical. The first one was, you've got to know your job. Too often we say, in the olden days, we used to have lots of characters in the military. I'd love to get back to that time when there were great characters in the military. Well, I'd like to get back to a time where everyone knows their job. If you're looking a guy in the eye and you go saying, go out and do A, B and C, and you get that look in the eye that when he looks at you as a commander, and you can see them saying to themselves, who is this goose? Is he going to get me killed or not? That's the ultimate test. And if we're sending people out to do things and they don't have the faith that you know what you're doing, then in my view, that's the cardinal sin. And there is so much technical in what we do at any level. I think there is no greater physical, intellectual, and kind of technical profession. There's nothing that compares to the military. Absolutely nothing in society that compares to the military. On five occasions now, I have accompanied, as a representative of Australia, I've accompanied a different country, five different countries down their road to democracy. Now, that's unbelievable. When you think about it, and you guys have got a Kipling-esque kind of look on the world. And if we go back and we look at the young Englishmen that would be sent out to India or anywhere, and the expectation was that they'd find themselves alone in some province with 10 million Indians around them, and they would somehow lead. A lot of them failed, but many of them succeeded. Many of them were able to make the cross-cultural links, and many countries in the world, particularly those that were, and this is a simplification, particularly those that were British colonial countries, have done very well out of that. There's been ugly spots, but there was a good element to it. Somehow, whatever we are in the military, and we can talk about this when we talk about East Timor, we can do great things. And that says a lot for us. If we get wrapped around the axle on technical leadership stuff, I think you waste your time. I know a leader when I see it, and I hope that people who follow me may know that I'm a leader when they see it.
And I reckon you've hit on a couple of points that we've reflected on with previous guests. One being that look the person in the eye, and actually that human part of leadership and that two-way confidence. And the second, you spoke about the cross-cultural, but also there needs to be a lack of hubris. You cannot go in, thinking you're bringing light to whoever you're leading. It's a two-way street, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And I think that I think it was brilliant. And I hadn't thought of it at the time when Army came up with its current values. And I can't, I've been out of the Army now for 10 years. What I did notice was that humility was one of those values. Yeah. And we've got great grounds not to be humble.
We've got an all right track record.
Yeah, we've got a good track record. On many, many occasions, that really serves us well if we are humble in what we do, but we still produce the results.
Let's go to 99 into 2000, East Timor, 20 years on.
Yeah.
You mentioned you attended a dinner last night that mostly was about East Timor.
Mm.
With the benefit of hindsight, anything you would have done differently?
From our point of view, we were a tool. We didn't decide strategy. We were a tool that acted in a way that over 20 years I personally had been prepared for. And over many years, people like Ken Brownrigg, who was the Army, I was the Defence Attaché, Ken was the Army Attaché. We had three other people with us down there and a whole block of people back in Jakarta. I don't think we made a mistake. And Peter Cosgrove has said that to us. There was an accusation this morning that one of the reasons that so many people died in that violence that followed the plebiscite and until Interfet came in was because we were so slow. You know, that is just moronically stupid for this tweeting person to say that. Because had we gone earlier, before we had a UN a charter, had we gone earlier, we would have been invading Indonesia. Now, you know, these people that sit back and make these moronic statements about what we should be doing have no idea of what the real world is like out there. So fools like that, if they expected the government to, regardless of the United Nations, regardless of the Treaty of Westphalia, which gives nations rights, for us to storm into East Timor and take it from the Indonesians, you know, we would have had a different result from the East Timor activities.
So your reference just then to the military as a tool, it's very reminiscent of these Clausewitzian ideas of war being an extension of politics by another means. Now, you've got, in Australia, a pretty unique position of having sat on both sides of those fences, war and politics. Do you think that, particularly in the West, we're getting away from that ideal, that we are lacking in, at times, that kind of political end state, that diplomatic end state that we want to use the military tool for?
I won't talk about Australia because it's too close. Understood. Let me talk about America, because what America does, we tend to follow. And it's a fascinating indication, in my view, the last American president that was prepared to be commander-in-chief, and this is the intersection of politics and the military, was Bush the First, President Bush the First. He was a man that was prepared to be commander-in-chief. He'd fought in a war himself in the Second World War. He'd been head of the CIA. He'd been a vice president for two separate terms. And then he became president. So he knew what to do. From then on, and who are the presidents after that? Clinton, Bush, Obama, and President Trump. The probability of them being successful or unsuccessful will be greater, I believe, because they were not prepared. Now, you can always ask advice, but, you know, the fact, and the irony is that I hold up Bush 1 as being the prepared person, yet he was booted out after one, when Clinton came in after one period of time. I think the greatest failing of America is the fact that their presidents haven't got a clue how to wage war. Their military is beautiful in how they wage war. They spend billions of dollars each year preparing their units and their generals to wage war. And what I found as a general going to Iraq, I found that my American equivalents were 10 times better than I was. 10 times better prepared for what they were doing. Now, I was a success there because I was in a senior staff position as chief of operations. But when I looked down at the American divisional commanders, they did and understood. They were all in their third or fourth war. They understood what was going on and they were beautifully prepared for it. But of course, it's no good if your political leadership gets you into the wrong war at the wrong time for the wrong reasons and you stay there too long.
Interestingly, so George H.W. Bush, I think, was the only one of those who actually had military service. Mm. A coincidence there? You know.
Bush too was a reservist.
Yep.
I just don't think that equates to Bush 1, who was a United States Air Force pilot in the Pacific, or Navy pilot, it might have been a Navy pilot, in the Pacific, shot down in the Pacific. Famous photo of him being dragged on board a submarine, having spent a couple of days in his little yellow life raft. But then that's okay. You understand a certain amount when you do that. But having been in the CIA, having been vice president, he was prepared to be commander in chief. Now that goes to the issue of luck.
Timing.
Luck and timing, exactly. Yeah. And that's what I find really interesting. Because the best president in the world, the best prepared president in the world, in his ability to link politics and the military, can fail because of circumstance. The worst president in the world could be brilliant. You know, and this is the strange situation we have.
Let's go reverse Clausewitz. Is politics war by other means?
Politics is nothing like war. It's nothing like sport. Politics is unique. It has nothing compared to the tensions of war. Having now sat with been one of the five generals that for a year ran the war in Iraq, and that was a little war. That was a bubby war. You know, this is we lost an average on the year I was there. We had 900 of our soldiers, the American soldiers, killed. Probably 10,000 Iraqis died in that year. 90%+ of them killed by the opposition. But the stresses on the leadership from the American military, American politics, looking down into their military, reacting back up into the military, the need to succeed, the need to back up presidents. I've never seen anything like that in politics. That was horrendous. The decision-making when you can literally within minutes to hours, and you guys have seen it on the ground, in literally minutes and hours when you can see dead people as a result of your decisions, is something which no politician really understands who hasn't been through this themselves. And we're getting more politicians with military service in. So to reverse it, yes, politics is a tough business, but it's nothing like, in its toughness, it's nothing like the military. Our lives are so much tougher than anything that I've struck in politics. It's just that I don't know enough about politics to stay ahead of the curve. But you got to live this. You can't be taught politics. That is the politics of a political party or the politics of how life goes in Parliament. You've got to learn it. Now, I just spent 18 months doing that, and I hope to get back in because I've got unfinished business in politics. But no, I just refuse to say that politics is worse than anything. It's not war. It is very polite. You know, it's got a nasty edge to it, but it's not like killing people.
So before we circle back to Parliament House, let's stay in Iraq in the year 2004. You were the chief operations for the multinational force Iraq. And one of the things that you don't know is that your close protection team leader was personally selected
is that right?
By me for you. He had previously also been in Ben's troop, and this guy, let's call him Andrew, was selected on the basis of not just exceptional personal skills, but incredible temperament. Now, you made a comment about him, and he's made some comments about you.
I know.
So firstly, the comment that you made about him, I think you said to John Stanley that this protection team leader, Andrew, told you that a senior ranking officer on your team would get you or them killed.
Yeah.
Now, you could have reprimanded him for being insubordinate, but you didn't. You took action against that higher ranking officer. Why did you do that?
It's very simple in that it's a belief that everyone should have a fair go. When I was a lieutenant, I made some monumental errors, one in particular, and I was given a second chance. I was prepared to give this fellow a second chance until the people that lived with him each and every day could no longer trust him, and that's what the manifestation of the leader of my close protection team, when he came to me and said, "Boss, this guy's going to get us killed." I thought, well, that's it. You know, I'm happy to bring someone along, give them a fair chance. But again, it wasn't his fault. We in the infantry live in a world which is so incredibly different than anyone else's world. And this fellow was a helicopter pilot in the Navy, had no concept of guns, of weapons, had no mental approach to violence, had no experience of treating, of being able to work with the kind of people that you guys have raised and trained for many, many years, and had no concept of what it was like out in the streets. And we're on the streets every day. Mm. And I found that, you know, and this was the manifestation of how big bureaucracies work, in that I was sent across there by Peter Cosgrove, and Peter said, you can take a couple of personal protection people from here. And ultimately it started off with two. And when we understood the situation, it became 12. And we had four armored vehicles. We had no car to begin with, but two personal protection people. It indicated that we had no understanding of the war in Iraq. Mm. We didn't know what we were doing. So I arrive over there, and this guy had been, the poor guy, and I do feel sorry for him. He'd been moved out of the headquarters because he was considered not capable of doing what he was supposed to be doing in a headquarters that never went near the battlefield. So what did they do? They sent him to me. You know, and I didn't know this, of course, until after the event. From then on, I got a series of officers that were just superb. Mm. A series of officers. Plus, the two people that you would have chosen went from two up to four Australians and eight Americans and four armoured vehicles, because we needed them. We were attacked 15 times over there. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. You know, one of the greatest systems that we have in the military is the Sergeant Major system. It gives us, you know, everyone's got a boss. We've all got bosses. There's a tendency within any hierarchical organisation to tell your boss what you think he needs to hear and what he wants to hear, etc. And so in a command situation where the boss sits somewhere and he's got X number of people working for him, but it's a human-based organisation like a military organisation is, we have in the military what's called a company sergeant major or a regimental sergeant major or a sergeant. And those NCOs and senior NCOs are worth their weight in gold, because if you're the boss and you've got people who are under your command, but you've got someone else that's sitting to one side that links back into the soldiers at the bottom level, it is a fabulous system. It's a fabulous system.
You reflected on being an infantry officer, and I'm hoping I'm going to get this Molinism correct. I love this line that I heard somewhere. You said, no one in the infantry ever goes into the field to get a good night's sleep.
No, absolutely.
Okay, so let's come back to your close protection team leader and hear what Andrew had to say about you in Iraq. Okay,
go on.
So I spoke to Andrew last night, and let me preface it by saying that he said quite unsolicited, in a quite unsolicited fashion, that you were one of the most superb officers that he'd ever worked for. He said, and I quote, you're passionate and smart, and for an officer, you had an incredible work ethic. Now, there's that obvious caveat there. Absolutely. I also want to add another factor, that he'd just come from working with Tim. He'd worked for me previously. The bar was pretty low. So
he knew smart, lazy, and dumb lazy.
He'd seen both smart, lazy, and dumb lazy, and then he saw what good looked like. Yeah. But he did actually say that you were the master of the power gonk. The ability to have a sleep anywhere. And he cited that even on Route Irish, which at that stage, most dangerous stretch of road in the world, bar none, you could catch some sleep in that situation.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because we don't know how we're going to react to this. And sleep management is a really critical part of being a military commander, and it really is a part of being a politician. Mm. I mean, you know, when I was working in the Senate, on certain days you'd go from 7:30 in the morning until 11:30 at night, and for a lot of people that's impossible, and I actually removed one of the American brigadiers that was working for me because he couldn't stay awake. And over that 12-month period, I worked probably at least 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, I had 9 days off in the middle, and if the fighting went over about every 2 weeks, you'd get a day where the fighting would go over a 24-hour cycle. So you'd miss that couple of hours sleep. And we did the most demanding part of my job was done in the middle of the night, which was time-sensitive targeting.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where you've got a very quick period of time where you find the enemy and you've got to kill them.
And, of course, make the decisions whether it's proportional or collateral damage. Yep.
So sleep management was extraordinary. Now, you know, part of my military experience was as a pilot. I'm a great believer in checklists. And the checklists, we had a house where all the Australians lived together, you know, the bodyguard and the XO, the major. And we lived in this little house. And I knew almost every night that I'd be up doing time-sensitive targeting at some time between 12 o'clock and 4 a.m. And to discipline yourself to do things in a process is pretty basic in the military. But a lot of people will get out of bed and they can't find one shoe. Or, you know, if you've got 10 minutes to get back because you've found someone, you've then got 40 minutes to take action to either kill them or not to kill them, then you've got to be organised. And I work to quite strict checklists. But if you speak to the so-called Andrew, we're attacked 15 times. And I reckon on every one of the attacks on the roads, I would have been sound asleep. The only time I could sleep was going from A to B, because I knew they were doing everything. At one stage, one of the guys said, "Sir, do you want some headphones?" I said, "No, thanks. I don't want to know what's going on."
One thing you might not know about the sleep management regime that was working on in your headquarters is that Andrew had instituted a policy that your staff were not to let you sleep, because he'd worked out that every minute of sleep you got resulted in another hour of work that they had to do at the end of the day. We had a
critical, you know, that we talk about battle rhythm. And in a headquarters, you've got to have a battle rhythm. And in a big bureaucracy, you've got to have this. If you're a hierarchical organisation, because in a hierarchical organisation, yes, of course you've got to allow people to exercise their initiative. But in a hierarchy, you can achieve great flexibility as long as the person at the top doesn't get tied down in detail. And so if you can manage your sleep either in a military situation or as a CEO, and you're not exhausted as a CEO, then, you know, when I see CEOs traveling amazingly, particularly now that Australia is a world trader, a world country, and you guys travel all the time. To be able to manage your sleep is a very, very important thing.
I mean, if sleep's a weapon, Ben, you are very well armed.
I am nuclear.
I got to say, I sleep as much as I can now.
Catching up.
Let's stay on the theme of leadership. Now, you returned from Iraq. You led the Australian Defence College, which principally teaches leadership at differing levels in the military. Being agnostic to the fact that people are either in uniform or out of uniform, regardless of industry or sector, public or private, what's the key piece of advice that you would give to any junior leader?
Again, I'd go back to the same thing that I took on all my life, and that is know your job. And that is just so overwhelmingly important. I came up with a number of points when I was speaking to middle-level management, military management and more senior military management about a philosophy that I'd developed about generalship. Now, generalship is what we call leadership on a battlefield, but for the military, it's pretty basic and you can cover it anywhere. And I said, this is what I came away from after my time in Iraq. And the first one was be technically proficient. Pretty obvious, you've got to understand war, understand decision-making. Understand the politics. That's the second point. Now, I reckon you can do this. You need to do this at any level. If you're a lieutenant, platoon commander, if you're a sergeant, you've got to understand the politics of how the lieutenant works, how the CSM works, how the company commander works, what happens amongst the sergeant's community. So understand the politics. And part of that is that you've got to watch your back and you've got to cover your ass. You've got to protect yourself in any bureaucratic organisation. And I see that as very, very important. The third one was to act legally, morally and ethically. And there is absolute, and this is before we get onto the traditional parts of leadership, this is to act legally, morally and ethically now is of overwhelming importance. In, you know, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, maybe even 30 years ago, you may have been able to get away with certain things, failings of yourself or your men. Nowadays, you can't. There's no way in the world. And that shouldn't be a motivation. You should have an ethical base that causes you to do this anyhow. The next one was know your strengths and weaknesses, then don't tell anyone. Because people will use it against you. But if you know what you're good at, you can do it. And if you've got a leader that is fabulously technically proficient, he can win wars, he or she can win wars, but they can't talk to human beings. Yeah. Okay, well, give them a second in command that talks to human beings. You know, you can structure someone who owns the company. And we see this all the time. We see it all the time in a civilian company that's based on innovation, where someone, an individual invents something, they then carry it, commercialize it, and they're invariably the most hopeless entrepreneur God ever put breath into. Well, leave them at the top, but bang in someone who can do the job below them. And that's well worth it.
100%. And the Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg thing is seen as the pinnacle of that.
That's good.
I say to
the young officers, apply both extreme violence and extreme humanity. And you should never lose your humanity, but we ask our soldiers to apply extreme violence, but it's never uncontrolled violence. And I think that's very, very important. Command so that people know you're commanding. You know, people want to know that you're the boss. They want to know that you can make decisions, and most of those decisions, the probability that they're going to be right is very, very important. And this is a particularly military one, but not necessary. I say the enemy will surprise you, especially when you think you have the initiative. And in the civilian world, there's a million equivalents of that. Now, if you really think you're doing well in the market, and then someone comes through with a disruptive technology and blows you out of the water, it's exactly the same as us. There's just less dead people around. Don't be scared to not know everything. And I've got to say that if I do have a failing, it was for many years to want to know everything. I don't think I over-commanded, but I did always want to know everything. And I still want to know an awful lot now, because knowledge is power. And as a politician, you've got to know things. There comes a level of command. If you're a platoon commander commanding three infantry sections, each of 10 people, or whatever an infantry section is now, you can know pretty well everything. But every time you step up in the military or in a company, you lose that intimate knowledge. But at your level, you must know everything that's applicable to your level. And the beauty of what I did in Iraq was that I watched my boss, General Casey, who went on to command the American Army, a million people. He understood that in this time of extraordinary high technology, nothing beats leadership. And he exercised that. He'd spend 4 days out of seven on the road, out talking to his subordinate commanders, the governors in the areas, the civilian kind of aid people who are out there. He was our greatest source of intelligence. He'd fly back in and we'd have a meeting each night at 10:30. We'd learn more from that meeting than any of the intel reports that came out from any other time. And the last thing I say is be very, very lucky. And this is what we were talking about in relation to Bush 1. Bush 1 oversaw the most successful war that the Americans have conducted for a long, long time, in the first Gulf War. Yet, in the end, he got blown away after one term. So regardless of what you do, you still got to be lucky, but you can increase your luck by all the previous things that I spoke about.
Yeah.
So that's the advice that I have given to young officers. It'd be interesting to see where any of them believed it, but you got to learn these things yourself.
Let's change battlefields.
Okay.
Let's come into Parliament House. Mm-hmm. You described politics, Jim, as being, and I quote, a crap job, unquote.
Did I? I deny that. For political reasons.
I will now insert the soundbite.
I came away from it with great respect for my colleagues. I may have a few problems with the party machine in New South Wales, but I have a great respect for my colleagues because it's a crap job. They work very, very hard, but it's essential to what we do.
Your first career was one of service.
Yeah.
Why did you then want to continue that service, but in an entirely different way in the political arena? What motivated that?
I had a fabulous exposure to politics in 2011, 12, 13. I was invited by Tony Abbott when he was in opposition to come in and assist in the writing of the opposition's defence policy, which I did. And at a certain stage, I ran into the now Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, who invited me to assist the party because they had a policy, and that policy was stop the boats. What they wanted was a strategy to achieve the policy. And I happened to be around, and so I was brought into that group, and I wrote, he and I were the co-authors, and he uses this term, were the co-authors of Operation Sovereign Borders' overall strategy. Brilliant people, like the current Chief of the Defence Force, were those that executed it. And the policy, like a good strategy, was continually adapted as to the situation in hand. So that was very good. Tony, I had no intention of going into politics. Tony Abbott then became Prime Minister, and he appointed me as his special envoy for Sovereign Borders. So for a year, I travelled around the globe, and I went to 15 different countries, some of them four times. So I just flew and visited each embassy around in the area where these people were coming from, with a bag of funds and a bunch of policies, and aligned the what we in the military would call the deep battle, and did that for a year, and we were successful. I thought it would take 2 years, only took us a year. Everyone said it could never be done. So we were feeling pretty good about that. And it is still, in my humble view, the most successful policy of the Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison government. It's a tough policy. It's an appalling policy. You've got to do this policy, you've got to have a rock solid ethical base. You've got to know what you consider to be right and wrong. Now, tough policy. And I came out of that thinking, well, these are good people. We've done good work. And people then approached me and said, why don't you run for the Senate? So I thought, oh, yeah, I've got nothing on tomorrow. So
I think you've tried to retire three times, haven't you?
And I've failed on every occasion, as my wife reminds me. But I did this, and I thought I'd learnt the system. And in those days, to be pre-selected to be a candidate for the Senate, you're pre-selected by 108 people, two from each branch, and they came together in a certain place. Well, we visited, Anne and I took a month off, we drove around the state of New South Wales, we visited 98 of those 108 people. And it was democracy at its best, where I, who wanted to be a politician, stood in front of a party member and said, this is what I believe in. They questioned me, and then they decided. Then, you know, silly on me. I thought democracy would actually go into the day of the pre-selection itself, and that was naivety in the extreme. And I was then astonished to find out that having done it, that the decisions were pretty well made beforehand. Well, I came out. I was selected in a certain position that then turned into a double disillusion. So I found myself in the seventh position, had no chance of getting in. This is in 2016, and all of a sudden, and so I said, "Okay, that's good. Now, what can I do for democracy within the Liberal Party?" So I was one of the two leaders of a democratic reform movement for the next 2 years in the Liberal Party, and we achieved plebiscites—that is, everyone voting rather than delegates—for the lower house seats. I believe that the 18 months I had in the Senate, I had extraordinary influence. I couldn't believe how much influence as a backbencher you get. You work through ministers, and you work through committees, and you do other things. It is a job worth doing.
And so it sounds as if your political career is not yet over.
I like to see the fact that the fact that I didn't get in last time was just a pure sabbatical.
You can reload.
That's right.
To paraphrase Churchill, this is not the end. It's not the beginning of the end. It's the end of the beginning.
I like that. I'll use that one.
Couple of big ticket strategic items. Maybe if we can dwell briefly on two things. You mentioned border security. Would you describe our border security policy in Australia as protectionist?
No, I wouldn't. Because I don't think that's relevant. I would describe it by what it is, and that is that every nation has the right to decide who enters their country. We are, per head of population, the most generous nation in the world to people coming into this country. But what the one thing we insist on is that they come through the entry ports. They come legally. And if they come by sea and they come illegally, they are called illegal maritime arrivals, IMAs. And regardless of what the lefties attack me on, the policy that the Liberal Party has had now for so long has been a life-saving policy. Don't tell anyone, but I get great kudos from being called the co-author of Operation Sovereign Borders. But what we did in Operation Sovereign Borders was something was a plan that I would have put together three times a day in Iraq. That's what we do for a living. We make things work. And we come up with practical plans that work. But so I don't use the term protectionist. I don't try and describe it in one word. I've been asked on any number, two major occasions now, to go to Europe and to talk to the Europeans about their border control, because they've got enormous problems in relation to border control. And on the first occasion when I went across there, I did interviews and I wrote opinion pieces and stuff. I came back and I said to the then Prime Minister, I said, there's no point us offering advice to Europe on how to control their borders for the simple reason they haven't made up their mind to control their borders. And that's still their problem. So the overwhelming thing that made us able to control the borders was not a word like protectionism or anything, protectionism or the word that you used. It was resolve. And that's what you got to have. And once we had that resolve, I saw Tony Abbott, Scott Morrison, and Angus Campbell work like work so well together. And the management 101 aspect of it was just so simple. We stipulated one person, Angus Campbell. We said to him, "Do you accept the job?" He said, "Yes." We said to him, "Here's the resources. Here's the authority. If you stuff it up, we'll sack you." That's pretty basic. And in a humane and good way, in a righteous way, we did it.
Last big issue before we get on to some more shallower issues. The International Energy Agency requires Australia to hold, or in fact all of its members to hold, a minimum of 90 days of strategic fuel reserves. Australia holds 55. In comparison, Japan holds 183. You've been very vocal on energy security. What should that look like?
The International Energy Agency, that agreement is not designed for strategic situations. It's designed, for example, if natural disasters occur in some part of the world, such as a ship blocks the Suez Canal or the Gulf dries up or something, they can't move tankers in or out, or Bangladesh, Or there's enormous floods in Pakistan and all the bridges are washed out. It enables the world to then assist other people. That was the basis of it. It was never designed for the situation that we now face in Australia. We in Australia are not allowed to count the crude or the product that's on the seas coming from all over the world towards Australia, and there are 45 ships on the sea at any one time. We can't count them, but in Europe, once they go up a river, and European rivers distribute it all through Europe, they can count that. So the falsity is just appalling. The hypocrisy is appalling. The point I'm making is that we need to look at it from our own interests, not from the interests of Bangladesh or someone else. We should say to ourselves, and this is why I advocate that in every question to do with security, The question is not how many submarines we have, or ships or planes or tanks or people. The question is, what's the strategy? What defines, at the moment we've got 23 days worth of fuel in this country. And that represents a fabulously efficient commercial distribution system. We don't waste time in this country.
Just in time.
That's fabulously commercially viable, but it's not secure. What we need is to understand the risk that we're taking in only having 23 days. You can only do that through a national security strategy, because it's related to the world risk that we face at the moment.
Last section, Jim. This one of our favourites. Quick questions, quick answers.
Oh, okay.
What makes you sad?
Not much, I must admit. Not much makes me sad. I'm never depressed. I don't get sad. I'm never overcome by events. No bloody idea why, but I aren't.
Just wired that way. How do you stay fit?
I don't anymore.
Yeah.
I believe that I was superbly fit for most of my adult life. I've now had a hip replacement. And as someone said to me the other day, who shall remain nameless, the beauty of having a hip replacement is that it makes you forget how bad your knees are. So I don't even try nowadays. What I don't do is I don't eat much.
Yeah.
And that keeps the weight down. But, you know, we in the infantry, we've been fitter than most people most of our lives, and I'm just hoping it lasts. But what I do still have is enormous resilience. And a lot of people don't have that.
Jim, if when you listen to music, what type of music do you listen to?
Well, I'd hate to admit that I like country and western. But modern country and western. But I rarely listen to music. The only time that I really listen to my own music, you know, I've got on my phone, I've got, you know, probably about 3 weeks' worth of music, is if I'm driving up to Sydney in my own car, I listen to music on the way up. But yeah, I like music of my era, of 30 years ago, but that's about as general as I can get it.
And you're not listening to music because you're listening to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. That's
exactly
the reality.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Do you have a favourite book?
Apart from your own?
Apart from my own, yeah. Running the War in Iraq, available on Amazon. No, I don't think I do. I read an awful lot, and Amazon and an iPad and Kindle has given me the ability to read like I've never read before, because I'll have three books going at any one time, and they are unbelievable. The ability when you're waiting to do anything to be able to call up a book, and I'm a great reader of history.
Mm-hmm.
And if I looked at the kind of books that I've read recently.
So for our listeners, Jim's cranking up his Kindle now. What have we got there, Jim?
Okay. He's just swiped off the podcast page.
That's right.
The Google says, what is Unforgiving 60?
That's right. I've just read a book called Captain Bligh's Portable Nightmare. There is Silent Invasion. I do an awful lot of reading for politics. I mean, Silent Invasion is a very interesting book about the influence that China has within our country. You've got to believe a fair amount of it. But no, I don't think I have a favourite book.
Mm. Jim, last question from me.
Mm.
You're going to host a dinner party, and you can invite anyone you like, living or dead. Who's on your list?
Well, I'd ask Bill Slim.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not first, but this is the way that occurs to me. And I know there's allegations have been made against Bill Slim after the war, but as a soldier, he was an incredible person.
So Bill Slim gets invited, but he's not at the head of the table. Who else have you got?
I could go back any the people that I do respect. A lot of military people. I had 40 years in the military. The people that I worked mostly with, General Casey, for example. I'd put Casey up there towards the head of the table. I have the greatest respect for two of the most recent Prime Ministers of Australia, three of the most recent Prime Ministers of Australia, the current one, because I'm a sycophant and into self-promotion, I'd put him at the head of the table.
What interests my boss fascinates me.
Exactly. But I'd put Tony Abbott up there. I'd put John Howard up there.
And we accept your invitation to
both of you
take the keynote.
Comedy relief.
That's right. But my links with the young Australia are mainly through my children. I've got four children, all of whom I hold in the highest regard, and all of whom are working their way through life and with the trials and tribulations that all of us know our children go through and which we all went through. And they're all doing it with a degree of ability which their mother gave them from looking after them. So I would love to have them. I found them as, you know, like all of us, I was away for a lot of their young lives, and I didn't have the right attitude towards them, so I didn't fight to stay at home. And my wife, Anne, carried the family for so long. As adults, though, they are fabulous people. And the last person, of course, I have to say would be Anne. We make the most important choice you ever make in your life is the person you're going to spend the rest of your life with. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And we've been married for, I should know, the number of years. For a long, long time, since 1972. And she's an extraordinary person.
And isn't that a beautiful place to leave it?
Jim Mullen, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Absolutely brilliant chat.
Thank you. It's good. It's good to talk, and it's good to be philosophical every now and again, isn't it? Not too often, but every now and again. Thank you very, very much.
Cheers.
Thanks, Jim.
It was brilliant.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
No, yeah. It's good fun. It's nice to talk.
So the sun is rising as the dark and draws a shade. Center dying, and the bells don't ring no more, and all the people all stop dancing years and years before. Just take it easy, prepare to blow your mind. You know that we're not teasing. You think that is scary now. Wait until you realize that it's all inside your head. Oh no, not me. Haven't died in front of me. It's not wise to loosen your disguise. Smoking as they rave, but once again, a renaissance is choking, and the bones pile higher, the cemetery's well fed, and so is all this genocide. Oh no, not me. Haven't died in front of me. It's not in your disguise. Oh no, not you. What the fuck has happened to you, East Timorese?
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at unforgiving60, that's unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.